Now, I've been using these terms invented by sociologists called informal work groups and primary work groups, primary groups and informal groups. They're the same thing, and terms are used interchangeably depending upon whoever you're reading, a sociologist or a psychologist. The terms come out of the study, the Hawthorne studies, at the Cicero Hawthorne plant of the American AT&T, American Telephone and Telegraph, those studies from 1927 to 1931-32 in there. I don't want to leave the impression, some people get the impression that an informal work group is automatically an answer to a jillion questions. That they're the purest thing going. No, an informal work group in any work situation, and we all have worked with them, all the negative in us is reflected as well as the positive things in us that are human about us. An informal work group is wracked by love and hate. There are serious disagreements within it. It's just that when that group is attacked, that almost invariably, in my experience, they will temporarily close ranks to protect one another. Now, management understands sometimes can pull a person out of group or buy him off, but that person doesn't last long. It is the isolation that they develop around that person who is finked is a terrible isolation.
Did management understand informal work groups in your experience in the auto plant?
Absolutely. That's how I caught on to it. I mean, management understood that if you even turn a person's operation around so they're facing in the opposite direction, you fouled up their participation in the group. They understand that the person who talks the most in the group isn't necessarily a leader. Sometimes it's the quietest person in the group. They understand, though, that if you can isolate, get rid of that leader, that the group is leaderless temporarily, and you'll have to come and find a new leader in another 6 months and do it all over again, that it's a constant war. You don't just do something to this group and the group no longer has any function. The group will redevelop its horns and its ability to fight. You got to do it to them again. It's at this level that war is constant at all times, in large factories in particular, but in large offices as well.
Do you remember any specific small battles won with in the plant?
Oh, God.
Did they ever try, for example, to identify and transfer out somebody from your group where it was obvious that they were just trying to break up the...
Well, I've been transferred out of a group. And at Chevrolet, they took me from as a spray painter from the booth and had me spray painting in the cellar by myself, little parts. They did this to me maybe half a dozen times. On the other hand, on a ship, for example, in Norfolk, the shipping commissioner came aboard, stop me if I've told this story already, and we all had to go sign in articles for the voyage. Shipping commissioner is part of Department of Commerce at that time, not the Coast Guard. And we had been in port for 2 weeks working together on deck. And affinities and friendships were already developing here in the deck crew. We're working together on deck, 11 people at a time. Well, not so much the carpenter, but the bosun and the rest. And I was the bosun. Carpenter works alone, taking soundings and doing any carpentry work. And I was first in, I was number one, naturally, called by the commissioner to come up and sign, because I'm bosun, I'm the first among equals. And I was answering his questions, and he says, look, son, he says, there's war on now, and you say, sir, when you talk to me. And I said, there's nothing in my union contract that says I have to say sir to you. in order to accomplish my task and my responsibility to this company. And he was livid. He says, you know, I could stop you from making this trip. And two guys, Dubazon, Creole kid, and Johnson, a blonde kid, both from Gulfport, Mississippi, stepped out of line, moved up to where they were facing, and said, if he doesn't make the trip, we don't either. They did that on a personal level as much as a union solidarity level. The skipper was saying to the shipping commissioner, we need him. He's a good bosun. Sign him on. Finally, the shipping commissioner said, all right, and he begrudgingly signed me on. But I remember those guys to this day. I bless them every time I think of them. how wonderful they are, I say to myself.
Is the informal work group a more powerful force at work than the union?
Oh, yes. And according to company literature, this is true. I mean, they hire guys like Nathan Schefferman. He was one of the most famous management consultants in the 50s and 60s. He says, their whispers are more powerful than our orders and commands. But I'll give you an example. We had a guy in our ride group. We got a good guy, but he's stealing paint. He's got a special thermos, and he's going home with a quart of good lacquer every night. We're painting his car. And then he stole the gun, a spray gun. And he cleaned it out with lacquer thinner, and he shoved it down right in his crotch. And some of the lacquer thinner got out and got in his schwants, and he was dying. He said, God, stop at a gas station. And he was in there about 20 minutes pouring water on himself. He's going to burn up. And we laughed and laughed and laughed, but when he got back in the car, finally, I said, sir, you're right. He says, well, you're not against stealing from GM, are you? And I said, no, I'm against you getting caught, because we're going to lose a member of the family if you get caught. And we need you. Somebody new, it'll take us a long time to turn him into another you. You get fired. He did get fired.
For stealing?
For stealing paint. In noon time, he's over there without his air on, and just the pressure from the paint filling up right out in the middle of the booth at lunchtime. Management guy came by and saw him and nabbed him, and that was the end of him. He couldn't file a grievance. There was little sense in it. If he'd used his head, he might have made up some lie, The head shop, the committee guy, the UAW committee guy, was worthless. And he wouldn't have been very creative in this kind of grievance. We might have been able to say
that. Were you still actively involved there? Did you go to meetings, WP meetings down in L.A.?
Not as many. That is, when I got to L.A., the group, the WP group, was falling apart. By this time, it was ISL. We changed the name in 1948 convention. We didn't want to be pretentious. It was Hal Draper's idea. It was a very good idea. We didn't carry it far enough. There's still people who didn't know whether they wanted to be bureaucrats on a vanguard basis or what, like Shackner. But
ISL, International Socialist
League. No, Independent.
Independent
Socialist League. I think it's a good name as far as Independent Socialist was for us. Still facing the CP daily. You know, Independent Socialism was a pretty good name. But when I got to L.A., I sent here as organizer, to be organizer, from the Bay Area branch where I was organizing. And really was an attempt to bring in new blood and save the day.
So when you went into
When I got here, it was very obvious it was falling apart, that the McCarthyism had really scared people badly, and they were, almost none of them were in industry. they were students or small business people or teachers and things like that. And as a result, another big factor in my going back in the plant was simply to return to a place where I would get confirmation of my ideas, because I wasn't getting it from my own people at that point. And I didn't treat them very well, as I rubbed their faces in their own flight, and which I hastened the disintegration by taking that kind of macho stance, politically macho stance. And so I really ceased to function as a regular party person right then and there, while working in Otto.
In Los Angeles.
Yeah.
When you did approach somebody about...
As soon as I went back to the Bay Area after the layoff in 56 and the emergence of the Hungarian Revolution, I was right back in again, yeah. Active again.
I was going to ask you about...
I quit smoking for 2 years when the Hungarian Revolution came on. I went out and bought a pack of cigarettes and started again.
Is that right? How long did that last? I hope it didn't last too long.
Until 1984.
Is that right? In the auto industry after the war, you mentioned that in your informal group, Mexican and black workers, what was their status in the... in the auto plants, as far as the stratification in jobs, did they have lower level jobs, or were they integrated?
I think that plant was pretty well integrated. Now, keep in mind that when you work in a department in an automobile plant, you don't know much about what's going on in the rest of the plants, departments. You're not an authority on the other departments in the plant. It's one of the reasons why in any kind of job action, when management disappears as a force, workers and factories always hold guided tours so they learn about what's happening in the rest of the plant. One night, my 9-minute break was coming up. I had drank out of that Coke machine down at this end of the plant so many times I knew every goddamn drink it had, and I didn't want it anymore. And that guy, someone told me they got root beer now in the one down in the trim department. Wow, just the thought of a root beer had me going, tantalizing me. I was ready. The minute I was relieved, bang, I went down the stairs. I went through raw metal down the stairs to the first landing on the stairs, and I could tell something was wrong in the trim line. And I stopped, and I looked, and I see two or three suits, white-collar tie guys, and a guy, a worker. Trim line is where all the trim takes place on a finished body. The motor's in. The wheels are on. The doors are open. They're putting in the cushions, the dashboards, the dome lights, and all that. It's going to roll off the end of the line another 50 to 75 yards and be finished. And this guy is telling him, he's shaking his head, he can't do it. And that car goes to the next guy, and they come in and they say, you do this. And he says, I can't. Well, what had happened was, you know, you get relieved every 22 days, you get relieved mid-morning or mid-afternoon for coffee. They start relieving you in turn, at about 7 minutes after the line starts, at the beginning of the shift. And you get your 9 minutes then, if that's your turn, if you're first that day, the next day you're second, and the next day you're third, and on like that. So what if you got to go in between times? Forget it. Some guy had gotten in this car and had developed a mountain right in the middle. He'd relieved himself of everything. It was immense. And these management guys are telling these guys to work on that car, and they're saying, nothing in my contract says I got to work under those conditions. And finally, so many management guys come, they push the car off the line to the side, and the management people have to get a bucket And the guy who holds the bucket is a little guy in the management totem pole in the crowd.
I guess so.
And they got a hose and everything, and they clean it out. Well, by the time I get back up into spray and body sealing, I have taken half of the next guy's relief. I'm late. And they're livid. Never happened before. What is this? I said, hold it. This is what just happened down in trim. And they died. They were rolling on the floor right then and there. They said, go back and find more. We'll take care of it. Find out what happened now. That story will never die of that day, because we won. It was a victory for us. And I was a messenger that day. It just turned out that way.
Well, so, again, I want to back up a little bit before we go on and see what you worked various jobs in Teamsters, and you said that one that you came at one job you ended up being blackballed. What's the story?
I got this job at Welch's Overall. It was right near where we lived. It was up on Mount Washington. I could almost coast all the way to work from where we lived, right down the hill. And if it was early enough in the morning, I'd go straight across Figueroa Street and right to the plant. And it was long hours we were working, 12 hours a day, for Welch's Overall on Pasadena Avenue. The largest industrial laundry in the world. Mainly coveralls, uniforms, Kex wiping towels, industrial wiping towels, things like that, aprons, industrial aprons. For example, the driver who had Technicolor as a stop, as a customer, delivered something like 800 pounds of coveralls to Technicolor twice a week. A tremendous business. It got me into hundreds of factories. I was the relief driver. I was the one, anybody got sick, I drove that route. Anyone went on a vacation, I drove that route. So I was getting a look at industrial Los Angeles the way I never, very few people ever get to do this, because I was covering the entirety of L.A. and Orange counties, Ventura, and part of Santa Barbara County. And knew all the routes. Okay. Well, when I went to the union to get the job, I went to the Teamsters building at 9th and Union Streets, and I went in one Teamster local office after another. There must have been 10 or 12 locals in the building. And when I got to laundry drivers, I think it was 926, Jack Anderson, Secretary Treasurer, said, yeah, I think we do. And he got Johnny Leggeri, who was a business agent, and said, what do you think about this guy? Why don't you talk to him about working at Welch's? And they had a man at Welch's who was an older man and had a route that he kind of half-owned. He had brought it to Welch's as his own route. And he... I just almost thought of his name. He had gotten, he had burned off his land. He bought some stump ranch up in the mountains. And he had gotten poison oak through the smoke of the fire he had built to burn all this brush. And he almost died. And so I had his route for 2 or 3 months, and I broke in with ease and, wasn't long after that, socializing with the guys at various coffee stops, they elected me shop steward. And I would get up and speak at local meetings. And the membership paid a lot of attention to what people from Welch's Overall said, because it's the biggest place. And I think what they saw was that new blood had entered the leadership, that here was a guy who was 30 years old and was articulate and was certainly more militant than the regular leadership. And I had come in with their blessing, by the way, the local leadership. I had made the motion for stewards because the stewards are the obvious people to meet new workers, and they thought that this was going to be, stewardship was going to be something that was going to aid them integrate new members of the local into the union via the stewards post. They didn't see that it was going to become more than that. What happened and how it became more than that was when the membership began to see that there were not just me, but two or three other young guys that I got along well with from other large laundries working together, they began to press hard for a better contract. They'd been sold out in the previous contract, didn't get a damn thing much. They lost. So now they're putting the responsibility for getting more on us young guys. And I really went and fought hard for it. And I went too far. I had such enthusiasm that I had lost touch with what the reality is. That is, I didn't understand the limitations. There was a certain line, there was a line there, and if I went beyond that, it was going to be, get this guy. And I went beyond it.
Who was going to get you, the owner of the...
Both.
And the union people?
Yes.
Were the union, Teamster union leadership not responsive to the demands of the workers?
Not at all. Not at all. They would have loved the fact that I would be a guy who was in their corner and looking kind of militant. That is, here's a red-headed guy with freckles who is everybody's stereotype of Tom Sawyer or Huck Finn and an American. And they don't expect this guy to be a Trotskyite or a radical or a wobbly or a syndicalist. And I was pretty much of a syndicalist, a militant one, and too much so. The other guys, the other two or the three guys, the young guys, they didn't play as radical a game. They were more careful, and they were more mature than I was. They didn't make the mistakes that I made. At any rate, they fired me in a ruse. I was a very capable driver and very careful. And there was one guy who had a route where he was doing things, strange things with the way he handled books, because a lot of the accounts belonged to him. He had brought them. This is another guy with the same. And when I took his route, I did it just like he did it. He made as much money when I was on his route as when he did it himself. And there was very creative stuff going on there. And I just did it like he told me to, and I didn't think about it. Because if I'd done it my way, he would have been caught, and he would have been out. And they owed him for those accounts, and they'd never paid him. So all these things were happening. But I kept the pink slip of the receipts on deliveries. You don't have to, but I kept it as my own record. And they came in looking for something, and they fired me for not keeping the pink slips in a neat stack. And then everybody began to laugh about that and how ridiculous it was. So they added to that I had stolen $1.10 by not being charged for that laundry by the plant, and yet delivering it to the man to whom it belonged and getting paid by him. And they had no proof of it. It was just their claim. But I was fired, and the only way I could get back was by an arbitration. Now, the membership in the meeting, the special meeting, didn't want to go to any arbitration. They wanted to strike to get my job back, and I went along with the idea of arbitration.
Did you think that you could get a... Were you unaware that that you had gone too far with the union, or did you think you could get a fair arbitration?
I know that in Wildcats, heads roll. And by this time, I had made a pretty careful assessment of what was. I had been fired for several weeks. And I'd had time to think things through, pretty much, in retrospect. And I didn't see that they had the ability to pull off a wildcat in any sense. Now, wildcats seldom, if ever, look good. If I had it to do over again, I think what I would do is the following. I would have stepped back, allowed the whole discussion to carry on about Wildcat, right there in the local meeting with all the guys present. And I would have waited longer before making my assessment of their weakness. And I believe that I was militant at the wrong time and conservative at the wrong time.
You counseled against the Wildcat, too.
I didn't counsel against it. I didn't speak up against arbitration. And I did not nail them. I was not aggressive enough. It was a failure on my part. I think that if I wasn't functioning almost alone as steward, I might have done much better. But for some reason, at that moment, I was not sufficiently bold.
Who represented you in your arbitration?
Well, this phony arbitration in which the head of the owners' association was the arbitrator from not laundered the head. The arbitrator was the head of the employers' association in the restaurant business in this town. And a personal friend of the guy who was head of the Employers Association for the laundry. And we showed up for this arbitration, and here's this guy, and I learned who he is. Now, they've been keeping me in the dark about the whole thing, and there's not even going to be a record kept of the arbitration. No tape, no reporter. Court reporter type thing or anything, and I got up to walk out. And Lionel Richmond, who was the second lawyer, number two lawyer for the Teamsters in this town at that time, said, "Hey, Stan, it's you and me against them all. I'm out for the Teamsters as their lawyer," as he had told me this before. But I had believed him, and it was a big act.
Yeah.
And he aced me out. That is, he let me go right down the tubes. And there were no witnesses, and no tape, no nothing, and I was just done. And it was a terrible lesson for me. Terrible lesson. I had failed, my boldness had failed at the wrong time. And I think that the main reason for the failure of boldness was that I was functioning alone. I had not built a base of two or three guys at Welch's. At Welch's, where I was at all times, whom I would see daily, who were like me and would kick my butt if I got out of line, or would support me when I needed it. And as I took the job too quick, without developing a base. And there are many other things wrong, but that was the big one, as I saw it later. I had real support from the guys. That is, after I was fired, between firing and the arbitration, the guys paid my salary out of their pockets. The guy came every Friday to my house with cash, another driver, and paid. And he made the collection and paid me. And when I got fired, I was paralyzed. I went into a state of emotional paralysis. Never anything like that had ever happened to me before, not that big in that way when I had responsibilities. Mary, I think, was pregnant? No. Yep. We were getting ready to have the first child, Kim, oldest daughter. And I was always riding on that thing, and I really was disturbed and distraught.
How long did it take you before you, after the whole experience, to get another job?
Oh, not long. I got one relatively soon. Once I saw that that was the end of the line, I went out and got another job. It was that some, I was spraying, going to be spraying trucks. These are custom-made trucks. I'm going to be the spray painter. And I'm doing a good job, but this Teamster guy comes in there and says, hey, you got to get rid of this guy. And the personnel man comes out and apologizes to me and lets me go.